a lone Democrat in the cabinet. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Nikki Fried is the new Agriculture Commissioner-elect. She won the recount over Republican State Senator Matt Caldwell. She's going to be the lone Democrat in the Florida cabinet. So how's that going to impact her ability to make inroads into three W's that she campaigned on? Weapons, weed, and water. She'll join us to answer your questions. Also, for the thousands who drive by it or ride over it every day, the space underneath the Metro Rail line is about to become a pedestrian heaven. The underline just broke ground. Within a few years, miles of that empty space will include parks and pathways. We're going to meet the woman behind the idea. And Alzheimer's impacts thousands of people in Florida, but is there a way to prevent it? A new University of Miami study looks at super seniors and what they can teach us about aging. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, it happened by the slimmest of margins, as is often the case in Florida, but Nikki Fried is now Florida's new agriculture commissioner-elect. Under a machine and hand recount vote, Fried was declared victorious by just a little over 6,000 votes. Fried will be a lone Democrat in the governor-elect Ron DeSantis' administration. She campaigned on a progressive platform of the three W's, weapons, weed, and water. Mrs. Fried joins us now to discuss her policy platforms, her wild election experience, and, of course, to answer your questions. Feel free to tweet us at WLRN Sundial, Facebook WLRN Sundial, or you can call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. And by the way, this may be a great opportunity, if in case you're not sure of what an agriculture commissioner actually does. Why not find out today? Let's ask. Ms. Fried, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, first, let's just say congratulations on the victory, but let's dive right into some of the big policy things because of what's going on in the news. On Sunday, Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri, he's overseeing the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. He suggested that teachers should be able to arm themselves as a school safety measure. He said it would be on a voluntary basis and require extensive training, but the proposal faces opposition, of course, from teachers' unions. How do you feel about that?
Quite honest, that's not something that falls underneath my purview. I try to stay into the lane. Obviously, Stoneman Douglas is in my backyard. I have said vocally that I agreed with the piece of legislation that passed last year's cycle. However, the one caveat was, arming teachers. But that certainly is not something, that falls underneath my administration or the policies that I implement.
Now, you've appointed Fred Gutenberg, a key gun control activist, who's on that commission, as part of your transition team. What role do you see him playing in this transition and possibly, again, talking about the issue of gun control policy?
Fred has been a huge supporter of mine because, as we saw in the previous administration, for 13 months, background checks were not done for concealed weapons, which is why I made it such a focal point in my administration, is so that the state of Florida citizens knew that why this position is important, that we have a key role in having these permits and making sure that there's background checks. So Fred understood this key position and its importance in the state of Florida, and has been a huge supporter. So Fred's involvement in the transition team, and the team is basically the charge of the responsibilities of doing interviews and hiring key staff in my administration. So he'll be involved in kind of doing some of the interviews and the recommendations of people to hire on the consumer side of my responsibilities.
And you talked about the issue that came up under the outgoing commissioner, Adam Putnam, the controversy that he faced in his final year with concealed weapons permits, and that many of them were just given out without going through proper procedure. How do you view the current permitting system, and how exactly are you going to implement any changes to it?
Yeah, I think that one of my responsibilities is to figure out exactly what happened, and if it was just a personnel issue, or if that was a climate that was being administered through leadership. And so it would be my job first is to do a deep dive and see if it's all administrative aspect or it's because of the climate. And people need to know that we'll be working under my administration, that things like that are not acceptable, that our job is to make sure that background checks are done in an efficient and effective mannerism. and making sure that the people of the state of Florida feel safe and secure and have, you know, our job is to do is, you know, servants of the people. And that comes with, you know, have huge responsibilities and making sure that people are confident in what is coming out of Tallahassee. So that's a couple things. I've also started seeing some of the things that have inside of the department, making sure that they're full-time employees who are doing the background checks. Previously, they were part-time employees. And then also having the conversation, which has already been started on numerous fronts, on actually moving the concealed weapons permitting and the other gun licensing to back to law enforcement. They are already instrumental in the steps of giving out a license. And that way you take politics out of the conversation is that you put it into law enforcement and they make decisions based on public safety, not on political persuasion.
Now, you're a former lobbyist, so you know how things are done in Tallahassee, and I just wanted to get your take on, even though, again, with your position and what your responsibilities are, you might find yourself having to deal with the power of the NRA lobbying hand in Tallahassee. I mean, how do you foresee dealing with that?
You know, the reality is that, you know, as you correct it, as a past lobbyist, you also need to know where your boundaries are. That, you know, if you want to actually change legislation and change policy, run for office. A job of a lobbyist is to represent their client and to educate people. But there's a line that should not be crossed. And I do believe that the NRA lobbyist crosses that line on numerous occasions. So I have no problem on talking to anybody who would like to have conversations with me. But their influence over the office and directing policy, as I've said numerous times in my election, stopped when I was elected. That means that having undue influence and the policies that come out of my administration will not be at the hands of the NRA.
Again, we're talking with Agriculture Commissioner-elect Nikki Fried. She transitions into the role in early January. We're discussing key policy points that she campaigned on. And if you have questions for Ms. Fried, we'd like to hear from you. You can, again, tweet us at WLRN Sundial. You can find us on Facebook. Again, look up WLRN Sundial or give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. As I mentioned, Ms. Fried, you are going to be a Democrat working with a Republican governor, a Republican legislature. What do you see as your greatest challenge moving forward?
You know, I think the greatest challenge is that everybody has a knee-jerk reaction, you know, when there's a split in parties, and making sure that the Republicans, who I know a vast majority of them, having worked in Tallahassee, that I have most of the, you know, all the issues that I campaigned on, I kept talking about that they're not partisan and that they obviously cross party lines and that there are issues that affect everybody in the state of Florida. And so my hope is that they are actually states men and women and want to do what's best for the state, and that does not mean a power grab, and that they're actually allowing my department to do things that we were elected to do. But no, I have long-standing relationships with both sides of the aisle. The things that I campaigned on are, you know, affect everybody equally, and really looking forward to having those good conversations with the leadership on the House and the Senate, as well as the governor's office, on how we can work together on changing some good policies for the state.
Does that also mean that you're willing to compromise on any of the positions that you've campaigned on?
You know, I think that's part of when you get an elected position, you come in with, I want to fix water policy issues. And so that means bringing everybody to the table and having a very constructive conversation and pulling together, you know, scientists and all the stakeholders and bringing everybody to the table. And so I will definitely take direction on what advice of some of the leading experts. You know, so I have been very vocal on wanting to be a proactive participant in fixing our water issues and the red tide and the green algae and water quality for generations to come. And so that's going to take a very, you know, dedicated team of people sitting around a table for, you know, 6 months to a year and come up with best management practices for how we move forward. So I'm very, you know, committed to doing things and very open-minded to what's the best path. You know, that's, I think, as I went through the campaign, you know, a lot of people were asking, why is it important that, you know, first female elected and what do you bring to the table? And I said, you know, I'm not worried about my ego. You know, I want to come up with good policy. And if somebody proves me wrong on a direction that needs to be taken. I definitely do not die on my sword. I want to make sure that it's the right policy for the state of Florida. And so I want to make sure we're doing those types of things. So if it means changing a little bit of where I came from, but my heart's in the right place and trying to fix these things that are affecting all of us.
Now, you talk about water. So that was one of the three W's for you, which is the water issues. Now, this was also a big one for Governor-elect DeSantis. He ran on the algal blooms in Lake Okeechobee and Big Sugar. It seems like you're both kind of on the same page here, but what do you see as the next, the big pressing issue that you need to tackle, this administration needs to tackle in the next couple of years when it comes to protecting our water? What do you want to go at first?
You know, what I want to go at first is that during campaigns, a lot of times it's easy to use political jargon. And, you know, we saw all of the green algae and the red tide, and everyone wants to blame somebody. And so fingers started being pointed, and a lot of it was politically driven. And so my first job is to make sure that we take politics out of the conversation, that we bring all the stakeholders at place. That's the agriculture community, that's development from the north, that's environmentalists, that's, you know, it's everybody, that's homeowners, and figure out the best management practices for the entire state. And that means, you know, having incentives for people to use less water. That means more education. And so I think that the first, you know, 6 months to a year, what I'd like to see is those kinds of constructive conversations and come up with a game plan of how to protect our water, because it is a natural resource that it isn't, you know, endless. And so if we don't start doing things today to protect our environment and protect our water sources, these will not be conversations that we're going to have in 4 years, because we will have done irreversible damage to our ecosystem.
And you know, we recently had, you know, one of the finalists for the $10 million George Barley Water Prize. And this is a prize from the Everglades Foundation to develop technology solutions for the algal bloom, not just in Florida, but around the world. Do you see private industry as the solution for the crisis, or does it all fall on the state, or maybe it's partnerships?
I love partnerships. I think partnerships are a great thing, because it is our responsibility as elected officials to oversee these types of issues, like from the DEP, from the governor's office, to water policy and ag in my department. So there's a lot of water management districts. So it's a partnership. But yet the people who benefit from it are on the private side. So outside of just general citizens. So there needs to be, and they've got a public-private partnerships and respect, and the private companies have more of the capital that they can utilize for some of this. So I do think it is a partnership, and it's leadership from both the private companies as well as from the elected officials.
The other thing too, and you probably saw this as well, is that the federal government released a report on climate change indicating that Floridians are likely to see more storms, flooding, more rainfall in the coming years from, you know, again, increased climate temperatures. That's going to have a definitive impact on agriculture in the state. So how are you going to work with farmers to ensure that they are dealing with this issue, that the state is helping them? And I bring it up because, I mean, from the last administration, there was a lot of, you know, a lot of pushback against the idea of climate change. But how are you going to tackle this?
Well, as you saw, the report came out. Climate change is a reality. And I think step one is recognition of it. Step two is coming up with ways that all of us, you know, this didn't happen overnight. And this didn't just happen by chance. This is something that is man-made, a lot of these issues. So that means that we need man solutions. And that means everybody. Look, you know, our farming community and our ranchers, they live off of our land. That is so sacred to them. And so it's giving them the tools and the resources to come up with new technologies and implement them on the way that they're using their best management practices. And then, you know, recognizing those that are the good actors in the you know, in the industry, and also going after ones that are not living up to their standards.
And did you, Ms. Freak, did you by any chance, I mean, during the campaigning, have the chance to talk with farmers? I wanted to get a sense of their ideas, their thoughts on the conversations about climate change, and how is it impacting them?
Oh, absolutely. We talked about it all the time. And a lot of the aspects of climate change is on the usage of water and fertilizers. And so we did talk a lot about that and new technologies and new resources that they can utilize, to make sure that they're effective and efficient in utilizing what is out there. So we did have lots of those conversations, and I went out to a lot of the farms that are using fantastic water management systems and upgrades. So there's a lot that's out there, and bringing new technologies into the state as well. We saw out in Israel, and I talk about this all the time, but Israel has, from a land of desert, there is, they created a fertile land and have some of the best industries when it comes to citrus and water management. And we got to learn from our neighbors to the east and to the west.
Okay, and how about also the fact that, we saw with Hurricane Irma, there was a lot of destruction on citrus. But I wanted to get the sense again from farmers is how do they feel about these conversations about climate change and how it's impacting weather systems, and it's going to impact the bottom line. Are they open to the kind of conversations that we see on coastal cities on resiliency and so forth?
Absolutely. Like I said, this is they live off of this land. They are feeling it. They saw, that the hurricanes are coming, and they're coming more fierce, and they're coming more frequently. And so they need to be doing things to protecting their bottom lines and to be adapting to what's happening out there. And so they're seeing it, and they certainly are wanting to have these conversations. There's a new generation of farmers that are coming up, and they want to make sure that they keep their land as well. And how they do that is they have to change too, and they have to move into new technologies and new resources.
Again, we're talking with Agriculture Commissioner-elect Nikki Fried, and we are discussing some of her platform issues and some of the things that she wants to tackle once she gets into office. And again, the new administration will be taking power in January. If you have a question for the new Agriculture Commissioner, the number is 800-743-9576. I want to go to Joe in Coconut Grove. He wants to ask you about one of the other W's on your list, which is weed. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot. Congratulations, Commissioner Fried. This is Joe Stone from Felony Miami. We're super
Hi,
proud
nice.
Of you. And I have a question
nice to see you again.
About the licensure for growers. How is that going to work under your administration?
Well, as you know, I don't over. So the legislature puts out that type of program. But I will be, I've obviously been a huge advocate of, more growers and breaking up some of the vertical aspect of it and making more people involved in the program and breaking down some of those barriers for entry, as well as also reduces the cost, which means better patient access. So while I do not have direct control over the licensing structure, it's definitely conversations that I've already started with the legislative leadership. Which I will continue to pursue and start having those conversations, even with Governor DeSantis, as we're going through some of these legal challenges that are still out there from the first couple of rounds of the application process.
And one of the things, too, is the fact that, the voters a couple of years ago overwhelmingly voted yes for legalization of medical marijuana. But there's been criticism that the legislature has tried to thwart that by making it more difficult for this industry to grow. Do you believe that, and what could you do about that?
Oh, I mean, I campaigned on that. I am a huge supporter of expansion. I do absolutely believe that the legislature and the governor's office has done everything humanly possible to stop the expansion of medical marijuana in our state. And so what I get to do is I get to be a vocal, I will have a soapbox every single day up in Tallahassee discussing these issues. I hope that Governor DeSantis realizes that I have a huge passion and knowledge base on this issue and will loop me in on conversations with the Department of Health for implementation, and that our legislative leadership will also allow me an opportunity to help create new laws to expand access. And then under my current administration, I have, oversee pesticides, and I oversee fertilizers, and I oversee edibles. So I do plan on putting out a rulemaking notice for the first week when I'm in office on putting out the edible rules and start talking about how we also move our state into hemp, which would also be under my authority.
I wanted to come back real quickly and ask you why you wanted to run for this position.
Yeah, so it's something I have always been from early childhood, always wanted to give back and to do good things for our community and our society. I was doing food banks and food deserts, food banks and Habitat for Humanities back in high school. And I always knew that one day I wanted to run for office and make a difference. It just was always a matter of which office and when. The reality is that the Commissioner of Agriculture is really such a huge responsibility in our state. It not only oversees our entire agriculture, but all of our consumer services, all of our concealed weapons, and consumer services is everything from fraud at the gas station pumps to auto repair shops to fitness centers, to our school lunch programs. And there's just such a huge amount of responsibility under this one position. And I felt that I can make the greatest impact by being elected into this position. And so I saw this as really as a way to change things in our state and make them better.
I know that it wasn't part of the platform so much for you, but, you know, looking back on your past, I mean, this was important when you were running for student body president at the University of Florida. You were the first woman in that position in 20 years. Now, when you left the post, you'd said, let's not make it about that. It's got to be about the right candidate. But you were running in the year that they were saying this is supposed to be the year of the woman, and we're in the Me Too movement. How important is that, you know, in having more women in these powerful positions in our legislatures? We saw a lot of women winning positions in Congress, but you didn't talk about it as much, but it was important though, right?
Absolutely. As the first female elected to this position, I felt it was important, and for a lot of reasons. One is, you know, I do think that women have a different negotiation style. Like I said earlier in this interview, that it's not about ego. It's about getting the right result. And so I come to an opportunity to, you know, come to a table and not come with my ego, come with wanting to be solution driven. And so that's a difference. And then the other thing, too, is, you know, I talk a lot about the campaign trail, my 9-year-old niece, and wanting young women to know that there are no barriers for them, that they can do anything that they want to and to reach for the stars. And, you know, the amount of text messages that I have received after the election from people that I had gone to elementary school, middle school, high school, college with, and talking about, you know, saying thank you, that they have, you know, taught their daughter. You know, I a friend of mine that I grew up in elementary told me that he told his daughter, this is what we teach about never giving up. And hearing those stories of people that I've grown up with talking to their young daughters about what can happen and to know that they can do anything, that gives me such inspiration that I'm getting to touch the lives of young women and young children across the state of Florida. Really is, you know, it touches my heart and really gives me the motivation to kind of wake up every day and put myself out there to know, like I said, when I ran for student body president, it was a big deal because I had been the first female in 20 years. And a lot of my platform was talking about the history of women in the state of Florida at the University of Florida. And then my outgoing speech said, I don't want to ever talk about gender in an election again because I want it to be about the best candidate. But the best candidate can be a female because they've been given the opportunities to lead and to gain those experiences.
Once you make that transition, once you are in office, what is the first thing that Nikki Fried needs to tackle?
It's all three of those major issues. you know, basically day one, I talk about gun reform issues, dealing with the concealed weapons permit. And I talk about that in respect of making sure that we've done the audit in the office, making sure we've got the right personnel, talking about moving it over to FDLE. And also, and I've said this numerous times on the campaign trail too, dealing with the concealed weapons permits and medical marijuana. That a lot of people have a question, if they hold one card, does that eliminate them from the second? And I've done my research and I will be making a very clear executive statement saying one has nothing to do with the other, that if you have a medical marijuana card, that will not preclude you from getting your concealed weapons permit or vice versa. I also will be putting out a notice of the edibles rule. I also would like to put out day one, a water panel, you know, a blue ribbon panel that's going to start going into all the moving parts of our water management issues in our state and start moving the ball on getting answers of how we can fix this for the future.
We've been talking with Agriculture Commissioner-elect Nikki Fried. Ms. Fried, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time. Got to get you back in once you're in office.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Well, just a reminder that tomorrow we're going to be talking with author Silas House about his book, Southernmost. It is the November title for the Sundial Book Club. So if you haven't joined, You got a question for him, you got to join the Facebook group first. So go to that, just ask to join. We're welcoming everybody. And then post your question. If you read the book, you got a question. I'm going to be reading those questions to Silas tomorrow. So again, join our Sundial Book Club on Facebook. Well, still to come, there are miles of space in Miami that's not being utilized. It's under the Metro Rail line. We're going to learn how we can change that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, earlier this month, officials broke ground on the 10-mile linear park in Miami known as the Underline. It's going to run under the city's Metro Rail line and will include dog parks, outdoor gyms, playgrounds, and plenty of space for pedestrians and cyclists. The park has been years in the making and was the brainchild of local Meg Daly, who said, We have a need for pedestrian and cyclist safe spaces in Miami. And by the way, I mean, you think about that. You saw the story from this weekend. Cyclist Denise Marsh was killed and five other cyclists were injured while biking on State Route 84 in Davie. South Florida traditionally ranks one of the worst regions in the country for cyclists and pedestrian fatalities. So could the Underline prove to be the alternative for cyclists and pedestrians? And what would you like to see in, you know, under the Metro line? What kind of things could we fit in that space that would be really cool? Meg Daly, founder of Friends of the Underline, joins us now. Meg, great to see you again.
Good to see you, Lewis.
You know what? I was looking it up. It was 2015. That's when we met. And we were under the Metro line at the Brickell Station.
We were.
In that open space. We were talking about this idea and just was thinking about all this empty space that wasn't being used. Except by roosters. I think a few roosters passed
still
by.
There.
They did, and they'll probably still be hanging around. Remind us real quickly again where this idea came from. I thought it was fascinating how you came up with it.
Well, it was soon before we met. It was 2014. I had a bike accident, and I broke both of my arms. So I've been in Miami my whole life. I was probably the first person in line to get my driver's license. So not being able to drive to get where you want to go is hard. But I ended up walking below Metro Rail to get to physical therapy in Coconut Grove. And I just sort of realized how much space was there and thought to myself, why aren't we doing something sort of returning this underutilized space to the community as a real asset?
And then there was this idea for parks, not just two pathways for pedestrians and for cyclists, but parks and all kinds of things for people to do. And really, the buy-in was pretty quick. The city, everybody really loved this.
Yeah, so it's really one of those, I think, special moments. We're going to look back in time and say that was a great time for our village to step up and become part of this community-based project. So we've come a long way since the idea. And the idea and what you see now is really defined by the people who've come to our public meetings, who have weighed in. Hopefully, your listeners today will call and let us know what they want in the future segments of the Underline. So the basis of it is the two trails, one for bicyclists, one for pedestrians, separated. We have to improve over 30 intersections with a bold new vision for safety, connecting the two sides of the street. So I feel no matter what my age is, I can get across the street or ability. And then we have all native vegetation. And then along the 10 miles, connecting the trail to these park-like moments where you see the gyms, recreational equipment, gathering spaces, public art. You can take off your headphones and lay down your phone and do nothing, or you can connect through technology to maybe even have like an augmented reality of what this park space looks like to you. It's sort of the park of the future.
It is fascinating. Just to mention, too, a couple things you said. So I wanted to mention James Corner Field Operations is the design team.
Yes, they
in
are.
This project. Because you'd also talked about getting public input, and they've been holding community meetings to get that input.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, what kind of stuff have you heard from people?
Really everything that we have in our master plan, which is online at theunderline.org, and in the first phase, Brickell Backyard, which is half a mile long, I mean, over 80%, maybe 85% of people said they demanded that we restore our nature with native species. So whatever was there before that we've ripped out, we're putting back in. They wanted us to sort of look at a sustainable future. What are we going to do with water? How are we going to be careful with stormwater? What are we going to be doing to make sure it's safe for people? How they really can walk and bike in a city that was really designed for people to be in a car, which was that 1950s vision. And how can we sort of experience the outdoors and each other going through three very distinct cities, multiple communities from Little Havana all the way down to areas near Dadeland? And how can we all share a space so we can come together and really share community?
So the groundbreaking was for the first phase. There are a couple of phases here. But the first phase, where does it start? How big is it?
So the first phase starts at the Miami River below Metro Rail and goes down to Coral Way, right by a beautiful little school called Southside Elementary. And the first half mile is really very distinctly designed for that urban context. We have a 50-foot communal table so people can dine together, eat together. That's always sort of good for a community, and sort of breaking bread and sharing a meal. Gaming tables for dominoes, checkers, and chess. Two dog parks, an outdoor gym that includes both soccer and basketball. And then we have this really beautiful moment by the school called the Oolite Room, where we have four butterfly gardens. And then there will be sort of these ambassadors who teach the kids at the school next door about sustainable growth and how it's important that we take care of nature.
So if you haven't thought of this, I mean, just again, you imagine the underline. You imagine that space under the Metro Rail. We drive by it or we're right over it all the time. And it's just kind of sitting there. But now fill it in with all of these things. How long is that first phase going to take?
So that'll take 18 months as one of the more complicated segments. I also meant to say that we're also going to have LED-based lighting. We'll have smart lighting that dims when people are not active, that it brightens up, and it's very respectful of the homes that are nearby. One of the other interesting thoughts is as you're along US 1, close to 90% of the people, we asked them, would you like to build a wall next to US 1? Or would you like to build a fence? Or would you like just vegetative border? Almost everybody said, just put in plants. We're really happy with that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, this is interesting because, and you said this a second ago, you talk about that route in US 1, lots of intersections. Mm-hmm. Have you found solutions? Is it how you're going to get across those intersections safely? And US 1 is it's one of those roads, and I ride it every day.
Well, US 1 is one of the major arterials. It's operating at basically close to three times its designed capacity. If you talk to anyone who really understands transportation, they know that our road system is tapped out, that we have to look at other ways for people to move, particularly short distances. But one of the fears is, how do I get across the street? And so, just to be real quick about it, we're basically tripling the width of the crosswalks. We're making them bright green. You can't miss them. With flashing lights so you can't miss them. We're offsetting them from US 1 so they don't hug the highway. And we're also giving pedestrians and bicyclists a little bit of a break, which is more time to get across the street without cars in every direction coming at them.
That's phase one. What's the next phase after that? Because it will actually be starting even while the construction's underway.
Exactly. So we have basically a third of the total project of 10 miles is funded. That funding is directed to Miami-Dade County. Every public dollar goes to the county. We are a nonprofit, so it does not go through us. We're not a conduit. So the first phase is funded, broke ground. We have a contractor construction. I'm supposed to hear the schedule this afternoon. I'm sorry I can't share it with your listeners. The next phase will go into procurement, which is the process of selecting a contractor. And that'll begin this spring. And so we're thinking construction will begin early 2020. That goes from Coral Way down to North Grove. And that'll be our first iteration of those crosswalks that are next to US 1. And DOT, the Department of Transportation, has worked very closely with us in getting our sort of out-of-the-box ideas on safety on the road.
Again, talking with Meg Daly, she is head of the Friends of the Underline. This is the project, the 10-mile plan linear park running under Miami's Metro Rail, just broke ground a few weeks ago. And the first phase of the park is planned to be finished, as she said, within 18 months. Something interesting you said in an interview with Fast Company that there will be a need for affordable housing and workforce development in some of the neighborhoods around the Underline. Mm-hmm. Local officials love the idea, but always talk about the issue of affordable housing. I mean, what do they say about, what have they told you about how exactly they could do that?
Well, you know, so this is one of our greatest challenges in our community is how we can keep the workforce near their work. And we believe we have this opportunity of a 10-mile park. Think of Central Park. What are we going to build alongside it? How are we going to bring more people to place? How are we going to make this amenity available to all? And it's really who lives alongside it. So this is their new front door, back door. So we always work in big initiatives. The first big initiative was to raise the $90 million that we have committed of the total price tag of $120 million. So now our next big initiatives are, how do we look at what is alongside the underline and how does it respect those communities and build a better community while bringing more people to the park?
And have you heard from any businesses that, you know, they see this as a great opportunity? They want to build next to it, or they want to be next to it?
Well, absolutely. You know, Atlanta is a great example. The Atlanta Beltline, Ponce City Market, you know, they have 1 million visitors on the 6 miles of the Atlanta Beltline that have been built. More people walking and biking. And the CDC in Atlanta, they say the best prescription for health has been the Beltline, not drugs. So there is a silver bullet, which is mobility. And no matter what your age, the more you move, the healthier you are. And we want those people who are walking from one place to another to stop in on that business on the way.
And you talked about the Atlanta Beltway, and that's also like the New York City High Line.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to get a sense of how you evaluate the impact that the underline is going to have on Miami, the way these had mm-hmm. impacts on those cities.
Well, a lot of people just sort of look to the economics of it and what has happened to property values, what has happened to mobility, accessibility, what has happened to public health. To me, I think there's another part to that equation, which is what has happened to community. We're so diverse here. Can we give people one language to speak in this public space, which is sort of love, kindness, and just sort of appreciation of the time we have together? And I think that happens over time. All these infrastructure projects that have used existing infrastructure and turned them into a public place have been wildly successful. The High Line in New York, they expected 2 million visitors a year. They get 10. The Atlanta Beltline was looking at much lower numbers. And it's hard to dispute, you know, that this stuff works. And so it's an exciting time.
I'll finish with this. How do you feel now that after, you know, starting with this idea and talking with so many different groups and agencies and government groups about getting this going, now that you saw groundbreak, you know, it's becoming a reality?
I was really excited in that moment. And then the next day, you know, the lights turn on and you realize you have a lot more in front of you. Our next big push is that Friends of the Underline is responsible for funding the maintenance and management and programming. So once a segment's built, this organization will take over the life and the activation of the space and keeping it clean and the trees, you know, pruned. And so, you know, we're going to be relying on the private sector in many ways to help us fund that.
Again, Meg Daly, she is the creator of this idea, this beautiful idea of the underline. And by the way, if you haven't seen any of the photos, go to their website. We have a link on our website. Check it out. All of this space for pedestrians and cyclists and parks, as she said, space to eat and hang out with neighbors. Sounds really, really cool. Meg, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Let's make it sooner than 3 years next time.
Well, you know what? Next time when you get that first phase done, we'll get you out. Okay. We'll be out there with you with the roosters and everything. All right. A note, coming up on Thursday, we're going to have another Live from the 305 segment, a look at some of the homegrown musical talent here in South Florida. This week, we're going to hear from Electric Kiff. You're listening to them right now. Still to come, a new study at the University of Miami that looks at super seniors as a way to help learn about preventing Alzheimer's. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, one of the difficult realities that comes with aging is the growing concern over things like dementia and Alzheimer's. More than 5.5 million Americans have Alzheimer's, according to the Alzheimer's Association. For people who've seen their loved ones go through this disease, there's a fear one day of them getting it. And this is personal for me. My grandmother passed away from Alzheimer's, so I got to see just how horrible this thing is. And a lot of us here in South Florida, we know we're connected to somebody who's been through this. November is Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and researchers at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine have a new study that says there's a way to successfully age and maintain strong brain health in our later years. They're looking at what they call healthy and successful agers. These are seniors who are socially active, engaged in hobbies and exercise. Researchers measure and assess the seniors' reasoning, attention, and decision-making. here to tell us about the advances in health aging and factors that contribute to becoming a super senior, as they say it, is neurologist and memory disorder specialist Dr. Christian Camargo. Dr. Camargo, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
No, thank you for having me. And let me just say, I'm very sorry about what happened with your own mother.
It was, thank you. It was eye-opening because it's dementia and Alzheimer's. I mean, you hear about these all the time. I had to learn the hard way, my whole family, what the differences are and really what this disease can do and how it really just takes a person away over time. But let me start with this. Help us understand the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's so people get that clear.
And let me just open up by thanking you for asking that question, because that is something that I can tell you right now is not only a bit of a nebulous and difficult question for patients, but you can even imagine for physicians that aren't specifically trained in this field. So if I have a patient who comes into the office and they say, Dr. Camargo, I have trouble remembering, really the first thing that I try to do, and as a memory specialist, the first thing that I think that should be done is to try to characterize the nature of these memory symptoms. Are they affecting every aspect of daily life? Is it really just memory? Is it more problems with planning? Is it problems with organization, et cetera? And then once I have an idea of what's involved and I assign a severity, I basically arrive at one of really three conclusions. Either A, the patient has some subjective memory complaints or cognitive complaints that don't necessarily pan out on testing. B, that the symptoms do show some deficits on objective testing, which I can do in the office and most neurologists and physicians can do. Or C, that it pans out that there is some measurable cognitive deficit and it affects their ability to live independently. This last entity that I've just described, cognitive deficits, in other words, memory, planning, organization, language, etc., that affect independence, that's called dementia. And that is the only definition of dementia. And this has to occur in the absence of a delirium or anything else that could be concurrently affecting their mindset. So that is the only definition of dementia, no stigmatization, no quote-unquote craziness, these unfortunate terms that are sometimes associated with that diagnosis. Yeah. It is simply that you're not able to be independent because of a problem with your thinking.
How do you come to the diagnosis of Alzheimer's?
That is very much the logical next question. Because once you characterize whether a person has a dementia or a mild cognitive impairment or simply a subjective impairment, the next question is, what's causing that impairment? And that opens up a Pandora's box of possibilities. Alzheimer's disease is only just one of those. Alzheimer's disease, especially now that we've learned much more about it with the research that we've done, is really a single entity. It's a biologically defined entity. There is a protein, for now we'll abbreviate it as called A-beta, okay? The presence of this A-beta and its deposition in the brain, that is how Alzheimer's disease is currently defined, based on our understanding of the disease. You don't need to have Alzheimer's disease to have dementia. There are many other conditions that likewise have their own quote-unquote bad proteins. One example is this disease called frontal temporal lobar degeneration, and this one is called tau. That's its bad protein.
All right. I want to get to your study here because
Absolutely. This
is fascinating. So, because this is the other thing, too, that I saw come up was, okay, if someone in the family is diagnosed, is it something I need to worry about? Is this a myth? And what do you tell people?
Yes. So it all boils down to what was the cause, right? Because, of course, some of these conditions do have genetic components, whereas others do not. In fact, some of these causes of dementia may be entirely related to environmental factors. They may be related to vitamin deficiencies. And in this case, you can actually have a reversible dementia. There are such things, or their thyroid function or what have you. However, of course, there do exist these genetic and familial forms. And so those are made apparent when somebody comes in and says, oh, my uncle had this, my aunt had this, my mother, my grandparents. And those, of course, have a little bit of a different approach.
Because one of the things I was going through the information on your study is that, so you're looking at these super seniors, people who are aging, I guess they're aging really well. And why? Is it because you're trying to figure out, is there a way to prevent? What are they teaching us?
Exactly. So this study is actually quite brilliant if you think about it. Because rather than do what the conventional, if you will, almost the easier approach to look at things when they go wrong, what we're doing here is reverse engineering when things go right. You want to find out, okay, this study, which enrolls 85-plus aged individuals that have successfully aged, meaning they're independent, cognitively intact, managing their own affairs, what is it they have in common that sets them apart? Something that we can identify. Common features. Is it their physical activity levels? Is there their levels of social engagement? Are there any particular gene patterns or clusters that they possess that are different from others?
Yeah, because, you know, what I wanted to get the sense of what is a super senior? These are the people you're looking at in this study. What's a super senior?
Oh, super seniors are just wonderful people. The ones that we've encountered here, these are people who are still teaching at universities even after they've retired. These are people who are opera singers and still engaging in performances. These are people that give back to the community, are doing, for example, one of the patients, or rather participants, is actually doing pastoral work on a volunteer basis.
So what I'm gathering is that this, basically, as we're aging, if you're still active, you're still working, you're still doing all the things you love to do, you're giving yourself a better chance at a better life. Right?
That is absolutely one of the assertions that we're making, and it's one of the patterns that we are observing, that basically your level of engagement, your level of activity, both on a social, physical level, does seem to correlate with a better outcome. Those are the more obvious variables. We're also looking at more subtle ones, of course, with genetics, with looking at the actual MRI of their brain. Everybody who has this study, remember, there's three visits. First, a screening phone call, and a baseline visit to make sure everybody qualifies, a follow-up, and an MRI scan, because there are maybe certain features in their MRI scans that likewise may elucidate to certain protective factors or even non-protective factors. The point being, we're looking at variables across all different modalities to try to identify these patterns of successful aging. Yes, exactly, to inform individuals at an earlier stage as to what they can do.
I'm speaking with neurologist and memory disorder specialist at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, Dr. Christian Camargo. He and his team are studying what actions we can take as we get older to prevent, perhaps, the development of diseases like Alzheimer's. And we want to hear from you, by the way. Do you or your family members have questions about Alzheimer's or cognitive disorders? Send us an email, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or message us on Facebook or Twitter, WLRNSundial. We want to post your questions and responses later this week. So basically, what is it you're hoping to get from this study at the end? Is learn from these super seniors what, and how would it help the rest of us?
As I said, it can help guide on many factors. First of all, it can help guide the things that you can do as an early intervention. For example, if we do find a link between certain types of physical activity, let's say, you know, high intensity cardio workout versus a different regimen, then that's something that we can more actively recommend. It could also tell us certain things that might negatively affect. What if the people who we end up testing, even amongst those, there's probably a gradient, some who may do better than others. We may be able to discern, hey, if you can avoid X, Y, or Z things earlier in life, then maybe you can successfully age even more successfully.
So is dementia, Alzheimer's, all of these cognitive issues, are they preventable?
Yeah, by the very fact that there exist reversible causes, then you can also logically conclude that yes, that many of these things are preventable. At the very least, even the worst causes of dementia can be delayed in their intensity, severity, and time of onset. There is this concept, and this is something that I really wish to emphasize. There's this concept of cognitive reserve, which is that based on your career achievement, educational level, number of languages spoken, that even if your genes have determined that at some point you will develop dementia or of whatever the cause may be, that it will likely have a later onset and that it will also hit you at a lesser severity than an individual that does not have those protective factors. And that, again, is called cognitive reserve. And this is very well established in the literature.
Real quickly, in the short time that I have, I wanted to ask you, too, about where medicine is right now and what kind of medications are out there to help people, whether it's dementia, any kind of cognitive issues they're facing, Alzheimer's. Where are we at?
Right. So there's really two sort of branches, the sort of established and the developing medication routes. The established ones, unfortunately, they've been around for quite a while with just really a very modest benefit. Whether or not they're appropriate for your kind of dementia, that's a conversation that you can have with a physician such as the ones that we have at our Memory Disorder Center at the University of Miami. However, there's also these new, more targeted approaches. Some people may have heard the very sobering statistic that 99% of investigational medications with Alzheimer's have failed, and that is unfortunately true. However, there is a paradigm shift into how these medications and drugs are being developed. New targets that are focusing less so on the bad protein and more so on the resilience of the brain. And for example, the University of Miami has just begun one such study. We are in the pipeline to begin two more that are focusing more on these sort of repairer approaches. So there's a promising future, hopefully.
Let me finish with this. You're still looking for more super seniors, right? How long will the study go?
The study's still enrolling until we meet capacity, which we're not at. So please, the individual to contact, her name is Stacy Merritt. The number is 305-243-1386. Again, 305-243-1386 for anybody who's interested in enrolling or who may know somebody who's interested in enrolling.
And we'll put that on our Facebook page, too, to make sure.
Excellent.
So definitely. I have to end it there. Unfortunately, Dr. Christian Camargo, again, neurologist and memory disorder specialist at the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. Fascinating study. Dr. Camargo, I wish I'd met you years ago.
Oh, well, at least better late than never.
Yes. Definitely. Thank you again. I really appreciate it. Probably. And I just want to mention, too, that if you or your family members have questions about Alzheimer's or cognitive issues, send us an email, sundial@wlrnnews.org, or message us on Facebook or Twitter at @WLRNSundial. We hope to post your questions and responses later this week. Well, that's the program for today, this Tuesday, November 27th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Tuesday. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.